Good evening, friends, and welcome to Valley Writers Read. This is Jim Ashford, and tonight, our regular host, Franz Weinschenk, is going to read a story of his own called The Dean's Dinghy. Although Franz says it's a fictional story, I expect that it's based on many real incidents that happened during his time as an administrator at a community college. So here now is Franz Weinschenk reading The Dean's Dinghy.
The Dean's Dinghy. Yesterday was November 4th, 1970, exactly 6 months after what happened at Kent State in Ohio last May. A rock-throwing anti-war demonstration resulted in 13 students getting shot by the National Guard, 4 killed. And the reason we remember is because of the huge 6 months anniversary demonstration held just yesterday in the free speech area right here on our campus. Thousands of students out there, instructors telling us hardly anybody in classes, most of them probably out there demonstrating. Ah, but look, today is another day, right? And despite AccuWeather's dire prediction about the oncoming storm, I decide to take the bike. You know, I just got it in my head that at times like these, my good old Schwinn helps me to keep my head halfway together. I mean, it's this doggone war. Somehow it's just taken over everything, every night on television, in the papers, on the radio, and certainly on campus. What's happening in Vietnam is consuming all our lives. All we're getting are demonstrations, protests, marches, teach-ins, sit-ins, and the latest, bomb scares. Some weirdo calls the switchboard and tells the operator there's a bomb planted in such and such a building on campus. And so we administrators get to be the bomb squad and search for something that we hope we'll never find. So that's why I figure the 20 minutes it takes me to get to and from the college on my bike just sort of helps me from going off the deep end. Okay, so here I am pumping down First Avenue behind one of those smoke-belching city buses, and in my head I'm planning my day. You know, the absolute first thing has to be to finish up the schedule of classes for next semester. That just has to be done today. Priority number one, numero uno, has to be finished by 5 o'clock this afternoon, and no excuses. After all, we have to justify our room assignments so that all these other departments out there don't get the idea they can just muscle in on our classrooms. I know they're just salivating to do so. Sure, they say they need more rooms because they have lots of students. Hey, look, we got a lot of students, too. And then, you know, I've got to finish up the faculty evaluations, which are supposed to be on the boss's desk, signed and countersigned by Monday. And on top of that, what about the grant application for the piano lab? It needs to be completed before the first of the month, or else, well, we'll just lose it. And oh, that's right, of course. Not to forget the big English meeting this afternoon at 1:30. You know, I can't believe it. These English people want yet another level of dumb and dumber English. Years ago, we just used to teach bonehead English for the kids who couldn't get into English 1A. But somehow, that wasn't boneheaded enough. So we started a lower-level bonehead class and called it Remedial English. And now, well, they want yet another class even lower than that. What are they going to call it? Eighth grade English for college students. Good gravy, when is all this going to end? When are the high schools going to send us some kids that know how to read and write? Right now I'm passing the big clock on the top of the GM dealership on North Central. It's 8:10, which means I'm making pretty good time. But then, wow, all of a sudden the sky has turned really dark. The wind is starting to blow. Hard. Looks like a storm is brewing. And before I can think much about it, peck, 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 I feel some hefty drops pelting my helmet. And in not more than 2 or 3 minutes, oh boy, it's really coming down. Wow, is it ever. AccuWeather was right after all. Taking the bike was a huge mistake. So I hop off in a rush, and I fish out my old poncho from inside my backpack. I slip it on as fast as possible. I jump on again and start pumping as hard as I can. Before you know it, I'm sloshing through puddles, being super careful not to let the end of my poncho on the right side get caught in the chain. If that were to happen, boy, what a disaster. And on top of that, by now my brakes are all wet and just about useless. But in about 10 minutes, I do make it onto campus, and I ride across the free speech area where just yesterday so many protested so vehemently. It's totally deserted this morning. Everything is bleak and bare. Getting soaked.
A look around. Leaves are brown.
Well, at exactly 8:05, I finally slog into the office, sopping wet. Oh, my goodness, says Mrs. Fernandez, our division secretary. Never at a loss for what to do, she immediately gets up from behind her desk and retrieves a towel from the storeroom. Good old Mrs. Fernandez. What would we do without her? But, you know, this morning, somehow, she has a kind of serious look about her. Something is bugging her, I can tell. Dean, she whispers confidentially as she hands me a towel. There's a very irate woman in your office. That very irate woman turns out to be Miriam, a heavy-set, middle-aged lady with straggly white hair, still wet and messed up from the storm. She lives less than a block from the college, and now she claims, for the second time in as many months, somebody, undoubtedly a student, has parked their car in her driveway so that there is no way in hell she can get her own car out to go to work. Dean, she bawls, almost in tears, if and somebody don't get that piece of crap off of my driveway in the next 10 minutes, I'll either smash all the windows out of it with a double-edged axe I have sitting in my garage, or spray-paint the SOB with a can of International Orange. Wow. So I call campus security, but they inform me that there is nothing that they can do because the scene of the crime, as they define it, is off campus and therefore not under their jurisdiction. So I dial the city police and I have Miriam talk to the dispatcher, luckily a very calm woman. After a short conversation, she hands me back the receiver. The dispatcher told me they're going to send an officer out to ticket the car, she says. After that, I can call the tow company and have the darn thing hauled away. Only trouble is, right now the cops are so busy on account of the storm. Look, Miriam, I tell her as I'm walking her out through the vestibule. Believe me, I'm really sorry all this happened, but you know what? Don't you have a friend you can call and maybe hitch a ride to work today? Or maybe call your boss and tell him why you can't go to work. Look, if you want, just tell him to call me if he doesn't believe you. But look, but whatever you do, Miriam, please don't trash that car. You got that? You understand what I'm trying to tell you? I mean, it'll just make things worse. I guess, she says half-heartedly, tightening down the bandana over her ruffled hair, once again prepared to rush out into the downpour. And as she's leaving, she almost bumps into Anna Marie Bankston, one of our English teachers. Anna Marie is a great instructor, but something terrible must have just happened to her because she looks absolutely awful. I've never seen her so upset. For one thing, she's totally drenched, and one of the sleeves of her raincoat is practically torn off. "The ceiling in my office caved in," she declared in a loud voice. "A bunch of water must have collected up there on those ceiling tiles right over my head and melted whatever they're made of, who knows, styrofoam or cardboard or whatever. And whoosh, everything came right down on me like Niagara Falls. I mean, I didn't expect it. All of a sudden, I'm just drenched in ice-cold water. Oh, what a shock. Dean, God, wait till you see the office. Everything is sopping wet. All the term papers I just corrected. Totally wasted. Totally lost. Compositions, quizzes, tests, homework, all my things and furniture, the typewriter, my books, the rug. Everything is absolutely and completely utter disaster out there. Good heavens, what am I going to do? I ask Mrs. Fernandez to get her a cup of coffee, then hustle into my office, and I call maintenance. But the secretary out there tells me that her boss, the head custodian, he's not on campus today. He's attending a sprinkler seminar in Bakersfield. Man, he sure knows how to pick 'em, I grumble. So I tell her about the leak in Anna Marie's ceiling. Sure, she says. She understands. But there are several other emergencies on campus at this very moment. She'll send Brady out as soon as he gets free. In the meantime, we settle Anna Marie in the workroom, and Francis, who's our work-study student, and I hustle out through the rain to Anna Marie's office. Oh, boy, she wasn't exaggerating. Her office looks like a tornado hit it. So we discard all the mushy pieces of ceiling tile. We tie plastic garbage can liners over her typewriter, the telephone, all her books, stacks of papers, her little radio, the filing cabinet. And then we put a big trash can lined with two huge plastic bags under the hole in the ceiling to catch the water, which is still pouring in. After about a half hour, I ask Francis to finish up, and I head back to the office. First, I pour myself a good hot cup of coffee. Then go ahead and check the mail. Nothing all that earth-shaking. A crusty note from Frederick St. Clair, the chairman of our English department, telling me that last weekend our debate team put up a huge banner in front of the library welcoming all the visiting teams on the occasion of a big forensics tournament. It read, "Welcome, debaters." But the word debaters was misspelled. There is no O in it anywhere, he tells me. When are these people going to learn to spell simple English words correctly? By the way, he continues, I hope you'll find time to attend our next English faculty meeting this afternoon at 1:30. Good old Frederick. He's fast becoming our school's number one curmudgeon. Really's got it in for the administration. Says they're really only an unpleasant reality that instructors have to put up with. Says that if all of them were totally eliminated, nobody would even notice the difference. But, curmudgeon or not, I have to tell you, he's a great lecturer. I've heard him, and he's outstanding. Teaches English literature, an expert on Shakespeare. Enough already, I tell myself. Let's quit all this daydreaming, buddy. You got work to do. Remember the schedule? But just as I'm walking over to get the folder with all the schedules, with a sort of a mild blunk, blunk sound, the lights go out. Not just in our office, but everywhere. The storm has knocked out our electricity, so that all we can do now is just sit there and stare at each other in the twilight and listen to the rain pelt our windows. Damn, I tell everybody, well, might as well go home. At which point, with a clock stopped at exactly 11:15, a thoroughly soaked student huffs in through the front door and shouts, "Dean, Dean, you got to come quick. The electricity's off, and there's a couple of students trapped in the elevator in between floors over in language arts."
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kick 'em down stones, looking for fun and feeling groovy.
So when I stand right next to the elevator on the ground floor and yell up to them, they can hear me. It's a girl and a boy. Thank goodness they seem to be okay. "We were on our way down from English," she yells, "when the elevator quit." "Are you sure you're all right?" "Yeah," hollers the boy, "we're okay. We tried to phone, but there's no dial tone. The only thing that's working is a little emergency light." "We're reading our assignment in English," she shouts. "Othello. You know all about this super jealous guy." I get their names and phone numbers. Tell them not to worry, that as soon as the electricity comes back on, which should be any minute now, we'll certainly get them out of there. Back in the office, I ask Mrs. Fernandez to call their folks and tell them what happened. Meanwhile, I call maintenance again, and when I finally get through, I tell the secretary about the stuck elevator. She replies that anything to do with the elevators always goes to her boss. "But he isn't here," I interrupt. "Don't you remember? He's learning all about sprinklers today." "Well," she says hesitatingly, "I do have an emergency number for the elevator company. Maybe I ought to call them." "Yes, maybe you absolutely ought to," I insist. "Okay," she says, "get right back to you." At which point, Mrs. Fernandez peeks around the corner of my office to tell me she can't get anybody at either one of the students' homes. And then, to her credit, the maintenance secretary calls me right back, like she promised. "The elevator people say they can't send anybody right now because their troubleshooter is on another emergency call, but he'll come as soon as he gets free." "That will not cut it," I tell her. "Can you give me the elevator people's number, please?" Which she does, and luckily I'm able to get the head elevator honcho on the line after only a short wait. "Yeah," he snorts, which sort of annoys me. "Look, you got to help me out over here," I tell him. "I've got a couple of students stranded in one of your elevators. The thing is stuck in between floors in our language arts building." "Yeah? How many you got?" "Two, a boy and a girl." "A boy and a girl, huh?" He sounded amused. "From what I hear about those college kids of yours, they probably don't mind that a bit, being alone in that elevator. You know what I'm saying?" he laughs. "Probably having the time of their lives, and you want to interrupt all that?" "Look, that's totally unacceptable," I snap. "Come on now. I believe we have a contract with you people." I was bluffing, just guessing that we did. "And if I don't get some immediate action here, and I mean right now, I'm calling our legal department as soon as I get off the line." And that's when he started to tell me about all the other emergency he has on account of the storm and how shorthanded he is. "Look," I tell him, "I'm sorry about all that, but at this point I am not interested in your problems. I want somebody over here to get those kids out of that elevator." All right," he said grudgingly. "I'll do what I can." And he hangs up. And just as I'm putting down the phone, through my office window, I spy Brady, the guy from maintenance, heading our way. He's weaving his way through the downpour, coming to fix the leak in Anna Marie's office. With a ladder slung over his shoulders, he looks like one of those fishermen you see on the outside of a sardine can, wearing a yellow raincoat, a yellow hurricane hat with the rim turned down. As he gets closer, I see he's holding a small coffee can with what looks like a tiny paintbrush stuck in it. I suppose that's the can which contains the goop that's supposed to repair the giant leak up on that roof. "It'll never happen," I say to myself. "Never. Never in a million years. So, once again, I slip on my drippy poncho and I hustle outside to intercept him.
"Where's the leak, boss?" he asks happily. "I'll just run up there and plug her up."
"Are you for real?" I ask. And even though I know this is probably a big waste of time, I walk him over in front of Anna Marie's office. "Look," I tell him, "there's a major hole up there someplace in that roof. You don't really think you can fix something like that with that puny little can of gunk, do you?"
"That's what they give me, boss. I just do it the way they tell me," he says, and he starts to set up the ladder.
"That's what they get for putting a flat roof over these offices out here," he says, climbing up. "I told them when they built this mess out here to put a gable roof on it." "Your flat roof will leak every time, boss," were the last words I heard before he disappeared over the edge. At which point I hurry back to the office, but just as I make the turn around the corner of the building, I am totally startled to see a police car parked on the sidewalk right next to our front door. Though the motor is running, the red and blue lights on top are flickering away, and both windshield wipers are frantically swooshing away the raindrops as fast as they land. There's nobody in the car.
"Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence."
It's on the inside of my office, behind dark glasses and underneath a large white helmet, that I meet Officer Patterson. At least so reads his name tag. He has both Miriam and a student by the name of Becky in tow. Once he finds out who I am, he recounts how, when he drove up to Miriam's place to ticket an illegally parked car in her driveway, he caught her in the act of breaking into said vehicle, a blue 1962 Ford two-door, which he explains belongs to this year's student, Becky Edwards, who showed up at the same time. "But I waited for you," Miriam bursts in, much agitated. "Waited and waited just about all day for probably 4 hours. And when you didn't show up and you didn't show up, I got so frustrated I decided to see if there wasn't some way to get into that stupid Ford so that I could maybe roll it over to one side of the driveway and get my own car out of my own driveway so that at least maybe I could go to work this afternoon." And then Becky, who is young, blonde, and attractive, tells her side of the story. "I'm sorry," she starts out, "but I just could not find a parking space this morning. I mean, it was raining so hard. I just couldn't find anything, and I absolutely had to get to my 8 o'clock biology class. Oh, you don't know. At 8 o'clock sharp, my instructor doesn't just close the door. He locks it. That means you cannot get a tardy in his class. No way. If you come late, you're automatically absent. You automatically miss the class. And he allows you only 3 absences for the whole semester. Any more, and you're out. I mean, out of the class. Well, I've already used my 3 absences. He would have dropped me from class. And without my biology credits, there's no way I can graduate. No way I can get into dental assistant school. Look," she pleads, her eyes brimming. "I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. And I'll pay for the parking ticket. But that doesn't mean she has the right to break into my car." "Can I get you all a cup of coffee?" I offer. "Sorry, but, you know, it's only lukewarm because of the power outage."
"No, thanks," says Officer Patterson. "That's against regulations."
At which point, Frances, you remember her. She's our work-study student. She sticks her head into the office. "Dean, Dean," she hollers. "The elevator man's here looking for you."
So I excuse myself, duck out into the outer office and over to Mrs. Fernandez's desk. Mrs. Fernandez, would you see what you can work out with the folks in there? Look, I've got to get those kids out of that elevator. I'll be back as soon as I can. Once again, I'm out in the rain. It hasn't let up. I jog around the squad car with its motor, wipers, and crazy lights still doing their thing, and I jump into the elevator man's pickup.
I am just a poor boy, though my story is seldom told. I squandered my resistance for a pocket full of mumbles, such are promises. All lies and jest, still the man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest.
He has a distinct Irish accent. Where is it now, he asks, the elevator where the young people are holed up? Right over there in language arts, I tell him, pointing the way. And just as we're walking down the dark corridor on the ground floor of the Language Arts building on our way to the front of the elevator, with an audible click, lo and behold, the electricity snaps back on. Hey, I holler. Hallelujah, I shout. You did it. You fixed it, I tell him. All right, now we can get him out, right? Wrong. He pushes and pulls every button, handle, and switch on the outside of the elevator, and he shouts up to the kids to do the same on the inside, but nothing, absolutely nothing. He suspects the motor is shot, shorted out by some water from someplace. Well, now, he says, his blue eyes twinkling. With the motor out, you understand there's no other way to get the elevator down from there than by sheer force of gravity. And goes on to explain that there is a brake which, if released, will let the elevator down, but you have to baby it down very slowly, gently, little by little, otherwise it'll crash down to the basement. And there are two other problems, he continues. One is that when you lower the thing, you have to stop exactly at the point where the inside door matches the outside landing. Otherwise, why, you can't get the outside door open without breaking it down. And on top of that, and most problematic, the braking mechanism is way out in back of the building so that the person working it really has no way of knowing exactly when to stop lowering it. Now we've got a little leeway, you understand, he gesticulates. Maybe 6 or 8 inches, but if you miss it by too much, you have to send the bloody thing clear down to the basement, break down the door on top, and rescue your stranded people through the roof of the elevator. Oh, brother. I look at my wristwatch. It's already after 1 o'clock, which means those kids have been in there for over 2 hours. At which point, Francis comes over with a message from Mrs. Fernandez. Dean, she says, Mrs. Fernandez told me to tell you not to forget about the English meeting. It'll be starting in just a few minutes. The English meeting? Are you kidding? The English meeting? Who in the hell can go to an English meeting at a time like this? Hell, for once they'll just have to get along without me. Do 'em good. Hey, Francis, how are things in the office? Oh, Mrs. Fernandez has everything all fixed up. Everybody's dropping all charges. They are? Wonderful. How in the heck did she manage all that? I'm telling you, that woman is a saint. Francis, look, don't go anywhere. I'm going to need you. By this time, the Irish guy has everything all figured out. That is about how to get the kids out. He tells us that we will have to organize ourselves into a human chain from the front of the elevator all the way to the back of the building where he'll be doing the lowering. Now, when the inside elevator door is just about even with the outside ledge, the kids on the inside will have to yell, "Now!" which is the signal to start the chain.
That is everybody hollering loud and fast to the person down the hall from them and around the corner to where he'll be ready to slam on the brake. So Francis and me start recruiting any and everybody we can find to be in the chain while he explains everything to the kids inside the elevator. We grab Anna Marie and Mrs. Fernandez and Miriam and Becky from the office. Francis even tries to recruit Officer Patterson, but he's still in his squad car with the motor running, writing up his report. Ah, and here comes Brady, just down from the roof with that ladder over his shoulder, still looking like a drowned fisherman. He tells us he doesn't think he has enough goop to stop the leak over in Anna Marie's office. No kidding, I tell him. Well, look, never mind that now. You'll fix it tomorrow. Right now, we need you in the chain. And I hand him over to Francis, who has him put down the ladder and walks him over down the hall. So that in just a few minutes, we're all set. Everybody ready, I holler, and I hear a bunch of okay, okay. And that's when the Irish guy starts lowering the elevator, very slowly, little by little. Suddenly, I can hear the kids from inside the elevator. We're almost there, they holler. Only 10 inches more. 8, 6, 4. Now, stop, stop. Now, repeats Francis to Anna Marie. Now, echoes Anna Marie to Mrs. Fernandez. Now, Mrs. Fernandez tells Miriam. Now, she screams to Brady. Now, he says, sort of puzzled. Now what? Now, stop the damn thing, I scream, for all I'm worth. Lucky the Irish guy hears me out back and slams on the brake. No need to get mad, Brady grumbles. You know, this never would have happened if they'd have bought a decent elevator in the first place. But nobody's paying any attention to Brady because we're all running over to the elevator door. Luckily, it hadn't passed the ledge by too much, and our Irish friend is able to open the door. Hooray! There they are. All they have to do is step up a couple of inches, and they're out of there. Yeah, says the young man, and everybody cheers and applauds. And they turn out to be pretty average college kids, not trendy or nerdy or zany, like everybody thinks college kids are supposed to be nowadays. No, just average young people, a little on the shy side with broad grins. Man, you guys have been in there a long time, I tell them. You don't even look a bit frazzled or upset, like it's something you do every day. Oh, we knew everything was going to be all right, the girl says modestly. And you know, we even got our homework done. Homework? Oh, come on now, jibes Francis. You mean you two, a grown man and a mature woman, all by yourselves in that tiny little space all day, and you're telling us all you did was homework? You mean you didn't even fool around a little bit? Come on now, not even a little tiny bit? Everybody laughs. And besides, didn't you have to go to the bathroom? More laughter. So are you going to sue the college? Miriam chimes in. I think you should, Francis agrees. You know, you got a dynamite case. I mean, locked up in solitary confinement for all that time. God knows, you could have gone bonkers in there. So I invite them over to the office, and while Mrs. Fernandez brews us all some fresh coffee, I have each of them call their parents again, but still no luck. And after we finish our coffee, I walk them out the door. Hey, what do you know? The rain has stopped. The weather is starting to clear up.
Are you going to Scarborough Fair? Parsley, sage, rosemary, and
once back inside, I asked Mrs. Fernandez, Mrs. Fernandez, tell me now, how did you do it? You know, that whole deal with Miriam and Becky and Officer Patterson. Well, I figured since they both broke the law, if neither one of them pressed charges, the officer was simply out of business. A genius, that's what you are.
The two offenses cancel each other out, right? Beautiful. Maybe life works out that way sometimes. Say, what time is it anyway? I look up at the clock. What? 4:30? I can't believe it. Seems like I just got here. Maybe you feel like you just got here, she says. But I feel like I've been here all my life. At which point, the phone rings. It's the head custodian back from the sprinkler wars. I catch him up on everything, the leak in the roof, the whole mess with Miriam and Becky and Officer Patterson, the stuck elevator, the whole nine yards. And then he starts to tell me about his day. Well, you just can't hang up on somebody like that, you know. A long time ago, I learned how to talk on the phone, just making small talk, saying stuff like, yeah, yeah, and sure, sure, while actually concentrating on something else. This time, I'm browsing through all my phone messages for the day. Mrs. Fernandez puts them on a spindle. Three are from my immediate boss, the dean of instruction, and one is from the president. Wonder what he wants. And just as I'm getting off the phone, I spy a note addressed to me on the edge of my desk. It's from my old buddy Frederick St. Clair, the English chair. Dear Dean, it starts out, it is extremely unfortunate and regrettable that even at this critical juncture in our department's deliberations about a new level of remedial English, that the dean of the division chooses to absent himself from our colloquy. I have been assured by the division secretary that his invitation to our deliberations was received several weeks ago, and that the agenda of the meeting reached his desk shortly thereafter. Whether by design or through carelessness, his absence from our deliberations cannot be interpreted in any other fashion than another crass example of his cavalier disdain for the importance of the work of our department. Nero fiddles while Rome burns. Sincerely, Dr. Frederick St. Clair, English Department Chairperson. I get out my fat marking pen. Wrong, I scribble on the note. The English chair babbles while the college drowns. Send me the minutes. Love, your friendly dean. I fold it back the way it came, dash on his name, and toss it in the out basket. And then, for some reason, my little side table catches my attention. It's been waiting there patiently all day with an almost toppling stack of manila folders piled on top of one another. Next semester's schedule, the evaluations, the piano lab proposal. Not one iota of work has been done to advance any of these. Not a single item. Absolutely nothing. There they lie, those fat little folders, peering at me ominously, just like they did last night and the night before. The storm has taken a day out of our lives, and while we were desperately bailing out our little dinghy, I'm sure others were making headway, consolidating their positions, figuring out how to get their grubby hands on our classrooms. Enough of this crap, I holler. Let's lock her up, Mrs. Fernandez. The evil of the day is sufficient thereunto. Maybe we'll get lucky tomorrow and have an earthquake or an insurrection or whatever. For a brief moment, the thought of taking home a folder or two crosses my mind. Ah, screw it, I mumble to myself. They don't pay you enough.
Tonight I'll sing my songs again. I'll play the game and pretend. But all my words come back to me in shades of mediocrity, like emptiness and harmony. I need someone to comfort me. Homeward bound, I wish I was homeward bound.
By the time I get to the bike, the rain has stopped, and a brisk north breeze is dispersing the clouds. I climb on the seat, which is covered with a plastic garbage can liner, and I head back out over the free speech area on my way home. Two quotes come to mind. Number one, some days it don't pay to get out of bed. Number two, to err is human, but to screw up royally takes teamwork. As I pump into the stiff but delicious headwind, I imagine that each breath of this clean, fresh, after-the-rain air is helping to expunge irritation, frustration, and self-doubt. In comes the good air, out goes the bad. In comes patience, good cheer, and decency, and out goes hubris, pettiness, and Frederick St. Clair, the English chair. And then I notice a large, crumpled placard, still left over from yesterday's demonstrations, stuck halfway down a sewer drain. All I can see is two words, Vietnam out. And it reminds me that Jeff will be 17 next January, only a year away from the draft. If he can get into college, he can get a deferment. But he's flunking French and always in trouble with coach out there in P.E. because he and his buddy Kenny won't pick up the trash and empty beer cans at the stadium after football games. That's not the student's job, he says. But even if he does get to college, I see him just like those kids at Kent State in Ohio who taunted the National Guard that day last May, defied and cursed and threw rocks at them, and then heard the almost silly little pop-pop-pop-pops of their rifles and buckled to the ground, probably not even aware of the smell of sulfur smoke from the discharges or their friends' cries of surprise, shock, and disbelief. Folks, I'm sure you've all had some bad days down at your office, shop, store, farm, or wherever you work. And while you're going through it, it seems awful and you wonder if you'll ever survive. But then, as the years pass, you look back on whatever happened and smile. As the old saying goes, you gotta live life one day at a time and hope for an easier, sunnier, less complicated tomorrow. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next week, our writer will be James Varner. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.